Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 31 of NML Crossing, where today's episode is going to be like one of those take a breath kind of episodes. It's a sit rep, a situation report. We're basically going to get ourselves caught up on everything that's gone on so far and kind of get the lay of the land for maybe what's to come. And to do so, we're going to be checking in with the flagship. So, I don't have much of a pre-ramble today, so I guess we can hop right in. I've been really, really bad with the pre-rambles, which may or may not be a good thing. I really don't know. I guess mileage may vary on listening to me talk inanely about silly things in my life. But anyway, let's get into it. This is Batman 558, which had a September 1998 cover date. The story's called Dying City, written by Doug Mensch with pencils by Jim Aparo. Ink, Sal Buscema, colors, Gregory Wright and Android Images, letters, Todd Klein, edits, Gorfinkel O'Neill, cover price, $1.99. And we open at the Batcave, where Bruce and Alfred are sharing an embrace. And I tell you what, I wasn't expecting that to be the first thing we see today. Bruce asks Alfie for help and strength. Now, this drops us right into flashback land, and we're at the funeral of Thomas and Martha Wayne. Bruce is, understandably, still shell-shocked and shaken by the loss. And so, mirroring the scene we just saw, he turns to Alfred to ask him for help and strength. Back in the present, the teary-eyed duo break the hug so the cowled one can hop on his motorbike and head to work. Batman hopes he can find some hope. I'm using the word hope a lot. He hopes he can find hope out there on the streets of Gotham, and enough of it in order to keep him doing what he needs to do. Once he's gone, Alfred returns to the task of tidying up the decimated Batcave by trying to pick up a busted stalagmite. Like, it's a giant piece of... Like, don't they have heavy machinery for that? Where the hell's Harold at? No, let's let the old man move great big hunks of broken earth. And I'm not sure if it'll be obvious or not, but I did put a pause in there, and I apologize for that. I just received a text from my buddy Dave of an Aurora Borealis that caused me to laugh quite a bit. If you've been following the show, we've been getting a lot of Aurora Borealis, so yeah, that was funny. Anyway, back to the story. We jump over to the GCPD HQ, where Commissioner Gordon is tending to some minor roof repair. He's interrupted by his wife, Sarah Essen. She offers a penny for Jim's thoughts, and he admits that he feels very, very guilty right now for the current state of things in Gotham. He wonders if there might have been anything he could have done to better prepare the city for disaster. And Sarah's like, dude, you're being silly. You know, the quake wasn't a crime that could be solved. It was just, you know, a really bad thing that happened. He's still troubled, however, and he mentions how all the big companies are bailing out and how survivors are leaving by the busload at this point, and it's only gonna get worse. Now, he feels as though he personally let every single citizen down. He says Gotham is dying, and hell, it might already be dead. He then asks how Mayor Grange is holding up, and Sarah says, well, she's doing just about as good as you are. From here, we tune into KGC's Siren of the Night, Vesper Fairchild. And I could have sworn there were different call letters for the station she talked on, but who knows. Anyway, it's here we start our halftime sit-rep report. It's time to catch up on all the events and stats of our story thus far. Now, Vesper, she talks bluntly about the state of things. She wonders aloud whether Gotham's done getting beaten down or if there's still an actual death of the city on the horizon. And I'm guessing the Bat Office probably was putting their ducks in a row here. They probably already knew where this was headed at this point. Now, she speaks of the sanitation department and how, due to the ruined roads, trash pickup really isn't a thing anymore. Now, we've got weeks and weeks, months worth of garbage piling up. Mountains, as she puts it. Which, you know, we could look at that a couple different ways. That's really good news if you're a rat, because the rat population has absolutely exploded, and with it, the risks of disease and plague. Now, she warns her listeners to stay away from the rats, which, I mean, you wouldn't have to tell me twice. Also, she points out you might want to avoid the wild packs of dogs, because, well, they don't dine on garbage. They prefer meat. And in times like this, human meat'll do. We hop over to the coroner's office, where Vesper reports on a statement made by Mortimer Gunt, the very fitting head mortician or coroner. Now, he's begging people to stop bringing him their dead. He says all the fatalities will have to be burned in mass pyres due to the risk of disease. He warns that this plague will make the clench look like a mild cold. Now, the clench, by the way, was the slang term for the apocalypse, you know, the apocalypse plague during contagion. Next, we head to the fire department, which is basically a skeleton crew at this point. Many firefighters are just plain given up, or they're too sick or injured to actually perform the job. Those who can, well, they're not adequately supplied with the resources needed, namely water. There's no water, and there's way too many fires. As she shares this bit, we actually get a scene where we get to listen in on a pair of firefighters talking about bailing out of Gotham as soon as they possibly can. Their wives want to go, and they're going along for the ride. From here, we hop over to the water department. Mains have ruptured all over the city, which leads to floods of dirty water, and that is lending to the ongoing cholera outbreak. Now, we saw Batman nabbing some of the cholera meds during that Arwen issue of Shadow, if you recall. We find out most Gotham schools are destroyed. The housing department's in shambles. Even its own admin building is rubble. Welfare is taxed out and benefits have been suspended because there just ain't any money. Standing in food lines has become a full-time job to many Gothamites. The lines are long and the food supply is short. She says even preppers are screwed due to the aforementioned rat infestation. Rats are eating up all the reserves, forcing folks to eat stale and rotten food simply to survive. Though, Vesper even warns against that, since, well, if you wind up sick with food poisoning, there ain't enough beds in the hospital for you. Ain't enough meds, either. Now, hospitals are in a weird position where there's a sort of sliding scale at play regarding who will receive medical attention. It's like, you gotta be sick or injured enough, but not too sick or injured, if you dig. Now, there was even discussion abound regarding euthanasia to put the hopeless out of their misery, but this was quickly taken off the table since they just simply don't have enough drugs to perform any lethal injections. So, bad stuff all around. But there is a light in the darkness here. We go over to the GCPD. Vesper says that they have been the strongest arm of Gotham during these trying times. Cops are still showing up for work, and they're even taking voluntary overtime. As she says this, we get to actually check out a scene. We see Harvey Bullock and Namor the Submariner attempting to stop some looters. They get bulldozed by the baddies, which shakes Montoya to her core, because one of the looters was her cousin, and she knows her cousin just had a baby the year prior. She worries that he was looting simply to feed his child. At the same time, she also worries that the child might already be dead. Vesper refers to the GCPD as heroes, as our view goes to Batman. Vesper talks about the cliche hero in crisis sort of stuff, and that's not the, you know, really terrible, you know, event series from a few years ago. This is more like the mother lifting her car off a child, that kind of thing. You know, that sort of stuff. Now, with a tear in her eye, Vesper says knowing these heroes are out there gives her goosebumps. She says it's a privilege and an honor to live in the same city as them. Meanwhile, Batman arrives at his destination, which... What? He's back at his parents' gravesite? Didn't we just do this? I know we just read this scene, right? I swear I'm getting like X-Labs flashbacks here where writers don't read each other's work and or confer with one another about what they're going to write. This is weird. Anyway, as he stands here, he sees some grave robbers nearby who are... While robbing a grave, of course. One of the grave robbers actually looks like Slug Stavro from that Huntress story last episode. I think I'm going to say it was him, because why not? Anyway, Batman beats the holy hell out of Stavro with a shovel and his fists before dragging him away. Slug's partner gets the F out of there as fast as his little feet can take him. Now this takes us back to the KGC studios where Bruce has arrived to pick Vesper up from work. They embrace, with Bruce asking her for help. And not strength, but hope. From here, we hop back to the GCPD HQ to wrap things up. Batman's on the roof chatting up the commish, and they talk about some of the survivors referring to themselves as the Quick. As in, you know, like the quick and the dead. After a few attempts at black humor, Gordon pretty much resigns himself to the fact that this whole Michigas is far bigger than him or the GCPD. Batman promises to help out in any way he can. And we close out with one last joke about how in Gotham City, the quick and the dead are the exact same thing. And that's where we leave it. Next time out, we're going to stick with the flagship. We're going to look at Batman 559. Now, before we chat this issue up, how about we take a look at our letters page here? This is Bat Signals for Batman 558. We're going to start with Brian in New York, who says he can't believe the Bat Books actually did it. And he's referring to the earthquake, of course. He can't wait to see if Batman will be able to cope, or if he'll just plain crack. He's looking forward to seeing how characters like the Joker react to this new normal. And he wants to see a ton of guest stars. And he names Robin, Nightwing, and even Superman. He wants them to show up and help, you know, lend a hand in the reconstruction. And he wonders if this was truly a natural disaster, or if there really is a Quake Master. Almost forgot about him already. That's pretty wild. And I know when we were chatting about the Quake Master, I wondered how the readers of the day received him and whether or not they thought he was a real deal, or if they might have been a little bit deflated at the prospect of a baddie being behind all this. But yeah, Brian wonders if he's real or not, so that's pretty neat. Next up, we got Ken in Texas, who has not read Batman in ages, but he does keep up tangentially. He reads Nightwing, because he's a big Titans fan, which is probably the last thing the Bat offices wanted to hear, because they were doing whatever they could to separate him from his Titans roots. Now, he really dug the Nightwing issue of Cataclysm, so much so that he ran back to the shop to pick up the Batman chapter, and then ran back to buy Catwoman, Tech, Robin, and Azrael. He even bought Azrael, you believe that? Now, reading this, it gave me weird pangs of deja vu, because I remember days like that, back especially around the turn of the century when I was getting back into comics. I had dropped them like 95-ish or so, and then moved across country in 97 and kind of rediscovered my passion and love for these characters. And I remember how exciting it was to you know, occasionally try out a new book and then like immediately falling for it, you know, be just so jazzed by it that like sometimes on the very same day I'd get back in the car and head back to the shop and I'd pick up the next issue. I'd pick up the issue before the one I picked up on a whim, and just to get more of what I'd gotten. And it's weird. The one series that always comes to mind, and it's such a weird one, the Kazar series. It was the Mark Waid, and I think it was one of the Cubit brothers. Or maybe it was, was it Ron Gani? No, I think it was a Cubit brother. And I remember picking that up on a whim, because I knew very little about Kazar back then, except that his first appearance was in an issue of X-Men. So it's like, yeah, he was kind of like X-adjacent. So I nabbed an issue of that, and I was shocked at how much I liked it. And I remember going back out to the store the same day to pick up more of it. And, I mean, we just don't get that anymore, I don't think. You know, it's such a different time where the internet was still there, but it wasn't what it is now. We weren't so reliant on it. We weren't getting all of our information there. So it was pretty cool. So I love that Ken has this experience with the Cataclysm books. You know, he read the Nightwing one and it's just like, I need more. So he went right back out to the shop the same day. I love that. I love that a lot. Now, he wraps up his letter by thanking the Bat Crew for bringing back the fun. And I hope that many of you out there can relate to Ken's excitement and my weird Kazar excitement. Next up, got Steve in California. Now, he was initially worried that the Quake Master was going to be revealed as having been, you know, actually responsible for the Quake. And he calls him a ripoff of Major Disaster, that one character from, I think we saw him in like JLI back in the day. But he was super pleased to see that it was a ruse, and he cannot wait for more. Next up, we got a special one here. It's Mike from Online. Isn't that adorable? Mike from Online. Now, Mike's kind of a dick. He says, I hope Doug Mensch doesn't consider Batman 553 to be among his best work. He pretty much says it sucked. The situations were unbelievable. The dialogue was poor. The art sucked. He said it was all too predictable. Steve must have a really good crystal ball. I don't know. He suggests that this whole thing is just a way of redesigning Wayne Manor. What? Was there ever like a set designed for it? Like, have any two artists drawn it the same way? Like, did Kelly Jones and Norm Brayfogle get together and be like, okay, well, the den goes here, then there's the parlor, and then there's 2.5 bathrooms on this one. Did they really do this? I mean, we can't get two artists to decide on a character's hair length or costume design. We really believe there was like a Wayne Manor floor plan they were sharing and expected to stick to? Come on, Steve. Now, if it's not already clear, Steve thinks Cataclysm sucks. So kudos to the Bat Gang for printing this letter. Now, Mensch attempts to diplomatically address Steve's concerns, which goes pretty much exactly how you might expect it to. I will say, it's almost a little too apropos that this is our first letter from online, isn't it? Speaking of which, we got Mark from online next, and he said that Batman 554 was good, but he's still got some quibbles. Quibbles from someone online? No effing way. Now, his quibble, as he calls it, is that he didn't like that Bruce stopped by Wayne Corp and didn't pitch in to help. Even though he was just there to get Jolene Relazzo's address so he could, you know, do the Batman thing and solve the crime. Okay, quibble, quibble, quibble. He loved the Jansen Buscema art, which I did not. So I guess different strokes. At least it wasn't a completely negative letter. Well, those were our letters. How about we talk about the issue? And I feel like I'm saying this a lot, but there isn't a whole heck of a lot to say. This is kind of just a recitation of things that we kind of read through. And, you know, like we said last time, this, and I said earlier in the episode, this issue is basically a situation report. And if I were a betting man, and I'm not, I would guess that it was around here that the Bat Offices kind of knew the direction everything was going to be headed into going into 1999. There were just too many specifics being thrown around for there not to have been some sort of a plan in place. And a little bit later in the episode, or actually in just a few moments, we're going to be covering some wizard stuff that might go a ways toward confirming that. I mean, we can see that the GCPD are the only branch of Gotham that are still holding the line. Question is, for how long? Spoiler alert, not very. As for the rest of the city services, they be hurting. There's no manpower nor resources. Hope continues to flicker out. And it's even getting in the way of Batman doing his job, and of course that's not a good thing. Really, this issue feels like a catch-up exercise, and that's not a bad thing, necessarily. I often have to, like, take a step back and get out of, you know, Chris mode and remind myself that normal people were reading only, like, a couple of Bat books every month. And hell, this might be the only Bat book they read a month. This is the flagship, you know? Somebody back then might have only read Batman, you know? So this was a good chance to take a beat and also kind of reassess the lay of the land. I think that's a very good thing. And I mean, I've been covering a book a day, and I usually spend at least a couple hours with each one, and I feel like even I got something out of this, so that's a good thing. You really can't get much better than that. I will say I could have done without another visit to the Wayne family graves, but otherwise, this was a pretty good and kind of sobering read. Definitely a necessary issue, I feel. And I feel like I said a few moments ago, this is where the rubber's starting to meet the road here. I think the Bat Offices, they know the direction. They know no man's land is coming. They know this won't be a quick and speedy turnaround. So this is them, you know, stacking the sticks here and getting everything in order to build the no man's land house. So good stuff, good stuff. Definitely a worthwhile and value-added read. Now, speaking of value-added reads here, how about we look at Wizard? We got some wizard stuff here. I promised it last episode. This is from issue 82, June 1998 cover date here. And we do have a fair amount of Batquake material in here, starting with the Buzz Bin, which is one of the regular columns that Wizard would jam in around the like I think like in with the letters in the beginning of the issue, there'd be a little buzz bin with some news blurbs and whatnot. And we got here, Batquake continues. Word from Gotham is that the Cataclysm earthquake storyline that shook Batman up is only the beginning of the chaos. Expect title and creator changes in the Bat Universe in late 98 and early 99. And we've already talked a couple episodes ago about how Alan Grant is about to wrap up his time on Shadow of the Bat. He only has one more arc after the 1 million issue. Doug Mensch, this is actually his penultimate issue right here. Next episode, we're going to be covering his last issue of Batman before it goes to Chuck Dixon for a few issues. The Road to No Man's Land story will be Dixon's, and then it'll go into the No Man's Land Round Robin. So it's happening, and it's happening quicker than I expected it to. Even though, I mean, we'll be at No Man's Land in this No Man's Land themed podcast in like episode 50. It still feels like it's happening kind of quick. Don't know. Anyway, next up, the Market Watch. This is where Wizard talks speculation, kind of. They kind of still stoke the flames of speculation, even in 1998. And here it says, Cataclysm rebuilds DC's bat books. Billions in property damage, maybe a million dead. Man, Cataclysm has been a lot of fun, hasn't it? Listen hard and you can hear Gotham City's residents screaming and fans' feet shuffling to grab issues of Batman Cataclysm, the story arc that leveled Gotham with an earthquake and the first Bats crossover in over a year. Already, some issues are up to as much as $4 each in some areas. Wow. $4 each. Ooh, because although retailers boosted their orders for Cataclysm, the boost was so low, it was as low as only 5% for some books. That translates to only a measly few thousand extra copies printed, and those have been snatched up lightning fast. Cataclysm keeps selling out as readers and reviewers pile on the kudos, and the crossover effect makes many fans buy every book. Prices could snap when DC releases a Cataclysm paperback, or the event, which has already decimated the Batcave and Wayne Manor, could have far-reaching effects that make it hard to ignore in the market. Keep paying attention. And, yeah, there has been a jump here. I'm still compiling the estimated sales numbers, or at least the units shipped numbers here. I'm trying to put that into a usable format to report on here. So what we have handy is the Wizard Top 100. So we just have rankings for the moment, but I will have harder numbers as we move forward here. I'm trying to figure out a way to deliver that in a way that won't be, I don't know, just like some idiot reading numbers. So I know I did that with X-Lapsed. I was doing the sales figures or the shipped figures or whatever the hell we're calling it, but I know that was probably some of the driest podcasting, and some, I mean, that's saying something for something that I produce, but we'll get there. We will get there. But we do have the top 100, so let's hop into that right now. The top Bat book of the month was the flagship, Batman 554. And this is, again, cover date June 1998, so this would be books from probably April or May. The next book came in at the 39th top selling, and that was Detective 721. That was followed immediately by Nightwing number 28 at the 40th top. Number 48, Shadow of the Bat 74. The 49th top selling book was Catwoman 58 or 57? One of those. The 50th top selling book was Robin 53. 54th was one of our one shots, Arkham Asylum Tales of Madness. 57 was Huntress Spoiler Blunt Trauma. And then we rounded out with our 60th top book here, and that is Batman Chronicles number 12. And finally, another thing I'm finding quite fun here is the price guide. Something that I remember when Wizard was a thing, right? When Wizard first hit in, what was it, like, 91, 92, we loved the price guide. Like, we would track the price guide religiously. Granted, I mean, I probably owned like 20 comic books total at that point, and it was easy to keep track of my portfolio, I guess. But as collections grew and the market dwindled, it became like, I don't know, it felt pointless. I mean, I never had any kind of, I never thought I'd sell anything. So it was like, It's neat to have it, but I never really looked at it. If anything, I would flip through and I'd look at the, like on the Wizard Price Guide, there'd be like one big comic in the middle of each page where it would be maybe a first appearance or a really good story or maybe a really bad story or it's the first appearance of a Mort of the Month or something. And those were sometimes fun to look at. But for the actual price guide, I very seldom looked at it. Now, with this project, I actually get to because I'm tracking the values. It's so dumb. I'm tracking the values of these books as they come out here to see what the ye old market looked like. And I can report here that all of the first issues of Cataclysm for the entire line, they all went up in value over a dollar. While the Market Watch we read a little bit ago said that some of them are up to $4 in some neighborhoods or some localities, the Wizard Price Guide has all of the first month's worth of Cataclysm books at $3 a pop. So they were $1.95 cover, and now they're $3. Doesn't seem like a lot, especially since, I mean, you could barely get half a comic book for $3 nowadays. But I don't know, I think it's interesting. And I've done a little bit of work, going forward here, and these books are going to keep climbing. And I think that's going to be really fun. What I'm hoping to do is go through the entire thing. We're going to chart it the entire way. Maybe go a few extra months after No Man's Land ends. And then I want to find some sort of reputable current day sort of price guide to see how they look 25 years later. Of course, there's going to be problems where we're going to have to try to sidestep CGC slabbing. Because, I mean, that Harley CGC slabbed could be thousands of dollars instead of the, dozens of dollars it would be unslabbed. The first appearance of a Batgirl could be hundreds of dollars slabbed, where it's dozens of dollars not slabbed. So we'll do our best to figure out an adequate way to track that. If anybody knows a good, reputable place to do that, please don't hesitate to let me know. So the first month books of Cataclysm are all $3, and the second month's worth of books in Cataclysm are all still cover price. Now, before we cut out of here, let's hop into the NM mailbag here. It's going to be probably a little bit shorter than usual, but we're going to start with our friend Ed Moore over on Facebook, who I asked a question, a silly, silly question that only someone like me would really be interested in getting the answer to, and that was, how do you bag your books? How do you bag? How do you board upside down, right side up? Do you use tape? Do you self-seal? Do you fold between the book and the board? Do you fold over the back of it? These are the silly things I want to know. And Ed was kind enough to share what he does here. He says, the book goes into the bag with the flap at the top of the comic, and I use tape. Self-sealing comics are right behind the word floppy as a travesty to collecting. My man, my man. I really wish I knew why that. I hate using words like trigger. It's almost as bad as the word floppy, but I don't know why the word floppy triggers me so much. Like if I'm at a comic shop and I hear someone say floppy or raw, like for an un-CGC slab book, it's all I can do not to punch them in the face. Like if I hear someone in the comic store say floppy, it's like I need to invite you outside. I really don't know why it gets to me so bad. It just comes across to me as like such a disrespectful term, and it's like you're trying to sound like you're cooler than comics. You're putting comics down, and maybe I'm a little too precious. I'll never deny that. But yeah, floppy. And if you work at a comic store and you say floppy. But thank you. Thanks, Ed, for sharing how you seal your books here. If I were to put books away for a while, I think I would tape them. But I don't know, with me, like I always feel like I need to get to them. I like they always need to be within reach. They always need to be accessible, and tape is just another barrier for me into getting to them. So I like I said last episode, I fold between the book and the board. I figure that's the easiest thing. It's the least likely to pop out because I used to do it over the board and the book, and then those would pop out sometimes. Or when I'd stick them in like an especially crowded long box, like the air would puff up and just shoot it right open, and then it'd be laying there, and it's just a pain in the ass. But yeah, I think if I were to seal them, I would use tape. I don't like the self-sealers either. I think those... It's weird. I think those are made for collectors, not readers. Does that make sense? You know, it's funny. I was reading in Wizard, the Wizard that we covered just now, and they have like the thumbs up, thumbs down section. And like, it's like, thumbs up, this story was great. Thumbs down, this story sucked. This art was great. This art was, you know, garbage or whatever. And in the thumbs down portion, they had a thing about variant covers. And they were like, we have 11 covers of this one, 12 covers of this one. And this is 25 years ago. And it said, this kind of behavior only breeds collectors, not readers. And I mean, same as it ever was, right? But when I see those self-sealers, that's what I think of. You know, I think this is for people who are going to buy a book, never even open it. Like, they don't have any interest in reading it. They're not interested in collecting the story. And I'm probably projecting and definitely painting with too broad a brush when I say this, because collectors come in all... I mean, readers come in all forms and have all different methods that they use and favorite ways to do things. So by no means do I have any kind of malintent with what I say. It's just, that's the first thing that I think of, is that if you have a book, you're going to seal in there with adhesive. It's, I don't know, for me, it would make me second guess any time I'd want to open it. You know, if I ever wanted to revisit a story and I saw it was in one of those, it's like, oh man, I'm risking damaging a cover here or having the flap hit it and glue itself to the cover. And I don't know, I overthink things, in case that's not totally clear. But thank you so much for sharing it. I definitely appreciate that. Next up, we got our friend Chris Yu talking about Shadow of the Bat number 79, which we covered a couple episodes ago. And he says, maybe it just speaks to the quality of the villains, and the villains were the Mad Hatter and Narcosis, but this kind of fell flat for me. Maybe I was expecting too much from the first appearance of costume villains post-Quake. It really did feel like a one-parter stretched into two. And that's something that that we pointed out during the episode, where it felt like, well, just like Chris said, it feels like it was a single issue that they stretched into two, and I suggested that maybe that was due to the looming DC 1 million issue. It's like, well, we know the November books are going to be 1 million. And well, we have this one story. We could get it into two just to get us to butt up against 1 million. And, you know, and like I pointed out during that episode, it didn't feel cheap. It didn't feel decompressed. It just felt stretched, you know, because I think, like I said last time, back then writers could do that, you know. They could write stories that were fluffed, but didn't feel like Brian Bendis crapped it out in 15 minutes, you know. Chris continues. The letters from people who had actually experienced the aftermath of earthquakes was interesting. I've never been through that kind of disaster, and never really thought of how a story like this would be seen by someone who had lived this story. The hopefulness of the people wanting to rebuild, even after losing everything in the Mexico City quake, hits home with the people of Gotham being excited by Bruce's attempt to give them a hand in rebuilding Gotham. And that's very, very true. I don't know that personally I'd be strong enough to do something like that. I think I would wallow and ruminate and probably just wither away to nothing. It's just kind of my way. In the face of adversity, I can sometimes be a shrinking violet. I'm trying to work on that, but it's always a work in progress. Chris continues. As someone who did read all the Bat books during this time, I don't remember thinking about where it was all going. It was just a change in the backdrop of where Batman's adventures were going to be taking place. Villains are still going to villain, and Batman was still going to have to stop them. The post-Quake landscape just felt like the latest Bruce Wayne subplot happening around the rest of Batman's story. It wasn't until No Man's Land proper that it felt like a major status quo change. And I tell you, it's because of that that I wanted to start so far ahead. I wanted to start with Cataclysm. I mean, I really wanted to start with Contagion, but that would have just been... that'd have been a long, long time to get... That's a long road to No Man's Land. But I definitely wanted to read these, you know, Cataclysm on, just to, I don't know, feel the change, you know? Of course, I've mentioned time and again, I've only experienced this via the abridged trade paperback collection. So I open up page one and it's No Man's Land already. you know, I didn't see the change. You don't really hear about it. It's just like, this is what things are right now. So the way we're doing this, I think it's going to be pretty interesting to see and feel like the status quo is changing. And I'm wondering if there's going to be like a hard line, you know, doing it the way we're doing it, where we're kind of hyper-analyzing everything. And we're kind of waiting, because we know what's coming, so we're kind of waiting for it. And I got to see if it has the same kind of impact as it might have back in 98, 99. But I think the way we're doing this, where we're really embedded, is going to be a lot of fun when we finally do get to No Man's Land number one, and see if the tone and tenor and just the overall vibe changes. See how we receive those stories. Because now, like Chris puts it here, it feels like Batman stories, of course, with a different background. But once the bridges are blown up and the tunnels are, you know, decimated, is it going to be different? You know, it's a whole different thing at that point, and I'm definitely looking forward to it. I hope you guys are as well. Now, Chris continues. I was a traditionalist, flap on the top, folded over, and taped. But I did encounter a rather unique system at a shop in my local area. Back issues were bagged with the flap in the front, with the price sticker sealing the bag instead of tape. That's a really cool idea. And I have never, ever seen that before. That's interesting. It's the things that blow my mind, right? I'm very simple. I'm a very simple man. But that board is on brilliant. Using the price tag to seal the bag. Jeez, never thought of that. But Chris, just like Ed, he sealed the bags with tape. You know, that's I think that's probably going to wind up being the most common reply we get. Because people are normal. And people don't need their comics at the ready like I do. Even though I don't look at them, I need them. I need to know they're there. I need to know I can just grab them and not have to worry about tape. I don't know. I'm just a weirdo. Chris continues. We've already established that my system was weird, but the number zeros and the number 1,000,000 type issues were a hybrid in my storage system. The number zero issues were with the regular monthly series before the number one issue, but the 1,000,000 issues were all together as one-shots in a secluded part of my one-shots box. The same went for Marvel's negative one flashback issues, or minus one, I guess, and amalgam issues, all together segregated from the alphabetical section in the one-shots box. Now, it's funny. I do things, I suppose we could say, traditionally, linearly, you know, linear and number-wise, anyway. My number zeros are in the front. My negative ones are before the zero, if there is a zero, or it's before number one in the Marvel books. And 1,000,000 is after the latest issue to come out. And I remember, like, when they announced Rebirth, and they were going to go back to the legacy numbering for Detective and for Action, the first thing I did was I ran to my boxes and I pulled the 1,000,000 issue out from, you know, behind whichever last issue of volume one it was, like 700 and whatever, and 904 for Action. And I put them at the end of the new 52 stuff because they were all going to count in that same, you know, legacy numbering. And so that was like the first thing I did, which is kind of sad, but I was very excited. Now, regular series stuff as one-shots, I kind of go back and forth on that. Back in 2016, we had Rebirth, right? It was the month that DC realized they could put out two number one issues of every single book, right? We'd have Batman Rebirth number one, and then Batman number one. Same month, two number ones, you get, you know, double your bang, double your pleasure, two entries on the top 100 or whatever it is. And I took all the Rebirths, and I put them together. Because I was on DCBS, I got the bundle, I got every single Rebirth book. And so the Rebirth one-shots I have all together somewhere. And I regretted it ever since. Because, like, I wanted to do some read-throughs. I wanted to do a Batman read-through. I wanted to do a Nightwing read-through. And it's like, crap, I got to open up two boxes now. I got to track down my Rebirth stacks and try to find them. Because for all intents and purposes, those Rebirth issues were basically number zeros. You know, they were what led into the first issue of the volume proper, right? So I regretted that decision ever since. And I always get a wild hair to like, you know, track down that rebirth pile and scatter them among all the, you know, disparate titles and all the disparate long boxes. But it's like, boy, that's like, that's opening up many, many Pandora boxes here. And it would take me forever. And I don't have all that much room to kind of groove right now. But I definitely wish I hadn't done it that way. I would have much preferred having them where they need to be so I can read things in order and not have to, I don't know, not have to fight with my collection. Back to Chris. He says, but now I need to ask something else. And this question makes me itch. What direction do you store your books in? By this, I mean, is number one at the front of the box with numbers 2, 3, and 4 behind it? Or is number one at the back of the box with 2, 3, and 4 in front of it? Oh, he says, my number one was always at the back of the box, and my run moved forward in the box. It made it easier to put the newest issue at the front. Oh, I'm not going to sleep tonight. Ooh, my teeth are itching. Yeah, I couldn't do it that way. I have to go in order. It's one in the front. Everything goes after that. And it's funny. My wife is a collector of vinyl. She loves vinyl records. And we went to a little record show at downtown the other day. And I was helping her flip through. She's a Swiftie. So we were looking for anything she could find in that regard. And records are different in how they file things. And even, like, I'll buy comics at a record store, I use record stores, and they file them differently. And by that, I mean, like, you know, you have your, I don't even know what you'd call it, the divider, maybe? The thing that with, like, a little lip on it, like a file folder where you can put, like, Action Comics, and then behind that you stick all the Action Comics stuff, and then you have Batman, you put all the Batman stuff behind that. In the comic shops, it's always, like, that divider is up front, followed by all the books. But at record stores and in record collecting here, it's all the records, then the divider with the name. Like, it could be you've got like 10 Taylor Swift records, and then you have a divider that says Taylor Swift, like at the end. And they do that with their comics too, because that's just the way they file stuff. And that drives me insane. Because my instinct is always to go behind the divider. Like, if I see Teen Titans on the divider, I think all the Titans books are going to be behind it. But at a record store, they might be in front of it. Which begs the question, if you guys use dividers, do you put them in the front or do you put them in the back? I don't know. More things to make me itch. More of those burning questions that only people like us will think about and worry about and lose sleep over. But you tell me, what say you? Do you use dividers? And if so, do you put them in the front or do you put them in the back? Now, do you file your books 1, 2, 3, 4 or 4, 3, 2, 1? Tell me. I'd like to know. I'd definitely like to know, because I'd never heard of that before. That's totally new to me. But it does sound like an easy way to store things. You know, if you get the new issues, you put them right in front. That sounds easy, but I still couldn't do it. But I want to thank Chris so much for sharing his thoughts on the issue and, of course, on his collection, because that's some of the funnest stuff about this show. At least to me. It may bore everybody else to tears, but I don't know. This is the stuff that unites us. This is the stuff that makes us comic fans. But I think that's where we'll end things for now. If anybody would like to join in on the conversation, I would encourage and invite you to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, all the socials, all that good stuff. If you have some friends who you think might dig the show, let them know about it too. And there's also the YouTube channel, which got a couple new subscribers there, but I think our watch time is like about a minute and a half per episode, because, you know, you click on it and it's like, cool, okay, we'll hear about No Man's Land, and then you realize it's just some idiot talking above, you know, over a static image. So I totally understand people clicking the hell off of that as quick as they can, but hey, maybe we can get them numbers up too. Who knows? Anyway, I think that's where we'll leave it for now. I'd like to thank you all so much for taking the time to listen today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Starting over won't be easy, broken, divided, split tomorrow from today. Knowing what you know just
makes it harder to think straight. Starting over after it breaks. Starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You better turn that page. When push it comes to shove, we do not fall out of love.